Access number 12696, reel 2.
Mr. Latham, reel 2.
As I was saying, that these chaps who had done the ab initio courses, as far as I can see, I think most of them have returned to their original lines of interest rather than to radar. For example, I have a friend who became an INCTAC, prior to joining the Air Force, was a young fellow in an income tax office in Aldershot, and he reverted to income tax after the war and became an income tax district inspector. And many more like that went back to their professions. But I think those of us who came in with some knowledge, however small, and managed to scrape through this trade test, I think we've sort of stayed at radio men all our lives. For example, I've continued with radar engineering until I retired a few years ago. Now, I forget what the question was now.
I guess you have the kind of people whom you're instructing.
Oh, yes. Well, I was saying they changed, really, from those who had the basic interest in radio to those who had it sort of forced upon them. But all credit to those chaps, because they picked it up in such a remarkably short time. And by the time they became radar mechanics, they had had a good year or more of training.
What were the main problems that you had in conducting these courses?
Oh, I think from my point of view it was keeping up with... taking practical sessions wasn't too bad, but when I got into taking theory courses, I think the main problem was to keep ahead of the class, to be sure that your lectures were credible. And I used to spend a lot of time doing preparation beforehand to make sure that, because we were teaching long hours, you see, we were teaching something like 7 or 8 hours a day, 6 days a week, somewhere on a shift system. It's pretty heavy going. If you got an off period, you felt you were really having a holiday, you know. So it was very heavy going. And we didn't have the advantages we have nowadays of things like photocopies. We had to write all circuit diagrams on the board to get the chaps to copy them down, that sort of thing. And to keep the lectures fresh and credible, I think the biggest problem was to really prepare myself and feel that I was ahead of the game and giving credible and interesting lectures to the chaps. Whether I did or not, I don't know, but that's what I was trying to do. And of course it wasn't easy to do that living in the environment of a training camp. The radio school, number 9 radio school I'm talking about, this was at Yatesbury, was way across the fields in a sort of remote spot behind the main RAF station. But we lived on the main RAF station, which was a training station, and there was drill and parades and church parades and inspections and God knows what going on all the time, guard duties and things. And a lot of what we regarded then as petty restrictions, and to the technical side and the keeping up with it technically, and preparing lectures didn't mix very easily with all this sort of what we regard as a sort of bullshit side. So I think that was one of the problems looking back. On the other hand, of course, we had a very safe war. We were not exposed to danger. We had a pretty pansy time. We were not being shot at or anything like that. So we had a very easygoing war compared with most people.
But were the pressures because the RAF was trying to push as many people through the courses as fast as possible?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, otherwise we wouldn't have had shift systems. I mean, you were training people at night time and daytime, and I think they were trying to get as many people as they could onto the chain, because the chain was expanding. If you look at a map of the radar chain in 1945... I haven't brought one with me, but you may have seen it, and I can give you one. If you count up the number of radar stations in this country, just in Great Britain, it's well over 200, about 220 or 230. That's the number of sites. Now, each of those sites had 3 or 4 radars on it, so that you're talking about hundreds of radar stations, of radar equipments, all working 24 hours a day, around the clock, and all manned with a watch system of mechanics and operators keeping them going. So the number of people involved was fantastic. And I suppose the RAF were just hard pushed to keep up the numbers. And of course they had to send people overseas as well. As the war developed, they were creaming off some of the mechanics and operators and sending overseas. So there was a constant demand. So I think the pressures were, as you say, just to keep the training going. It really went at a hell of a pace.
What kind of changes, though, occurred as the war went on and it became apparent that Germany was going to be soon defeated?
I think it did ease off a bit at Yatesbury towards the end, but I can't really comment much on that because for the last couple of years, although I was still on the books of Yatesbury Training Command, I was detached to these other places I mentioned earlier, Renscombe Down and Tame, to teach chaps to go off with these mobile navigation systems, and the pressure on that was quite high. So as far as I saw it, the pressure continued pretty strongly, but it may be that back at base things have been easing off somewhat. It could be.
In the practical sessions you were talking about, what typically would you demonstrate on the equipment?
You'd have, for example, a transmitter, like one of the famous transmitters called the MB2 transmitter, which it was the transmitter used on the West Coast CH stations, and also in a modified form for the G stations. You'd have your transmitter there. You'd have, perhaps in a building, you'd have three or four MB2 transmitters, and the class would be a class of perhaps 18 or 20 people would be split into, say, three, so you'd have groups of perhaps half a dozen. So you'd have your transmitter and a group of half a dozen around. You would teach them the layout of the transmitter, where every component was, and quiz them on it and get them to show you where all the bits and pieces were. And when they were familiar with that, you'd show them the running up and down procedure, because these transmitters are not like modern transmitters where you press a button and they come on at once. You had to go through a running up procedure. You press on button, you wait for the filaments to come, you set the filament volts, you set the modulator current, then you set something else, you set something else. Finally, you set the main HT and wind the transmitter up to its full working voltage, having made a number of checks all the way. So this is a routine that you would teach the chaps to do. And when they got the running up routine off pat, and when they were all able to do it, then you would put faults on for them. You would put in dud components. We had a whole armoury of tricks that we used to put on, and we'd find how long it took them to find the faults. We'd mark them and assess them accordingly. And it was really quite tough, I think, to do that. And of course, in the evenings when we had time off, I and a particular friend of mine, Maurice Keast, who's since died, he was a fine mechanic, we used to go back to the school in the evenings and put faults on for each other if we had any spare time. That was our favourite pastime. We didn't care much for the dances and the social events. We were perhaps a bit antisocial. We used to get out of the school and put faults on for each other, and we'd take bets or timing. He put the most devilish faults on for me, and I would rush around and perhaps clear the faults within 5 minutes or something, and then I put one on for him and he'd clear it within 4 minutes and he would win, that sort of thing. So that's what we used to do with transmitters, and same with receivers too. There was the receiver called the RF6 and the RF7 receivers, which were quite big standing things. They were standing up. I mean, they'd only get one in this room, just about. Very complicated receiver. And you'd put some awful fault on there, it would be all defocused, or the receiver gain would have gone, or the thing would be unstable because you'd done something devilish inside. And it was his job to find out what was wrong. And that way we used to keep a kind of repertoire of tricks and special faults, you see, that we could put on for the trainees. We've got some really good, bright trainees. We'd try them out on some of these real stinkers. And on the whole, they were very good. They found some of the faults.
Was there any liaison with foreign personnel, like Americans?
Yes, Americans in particular. I think during the war, Americans are the only ones I remember. We had quite a lot of Americans in about 43, there was an equipment called LW, which stands for Light Warning. It was a mobile radar, 1.5 metre mobile radar, and we were teaching them on that. And I was then taking practical sessions with the Americans on that at that time. And I remember standing one day, looking down a very long path that used to lead from the main camp down to the radio school. And you could see along this path for a matter of a quarter of a mile or something. And the Americans were straggling down, the American officers. And what struck me as so strange was they were all quite clearly American officers and nothing else but. And they were all dressed differently. They were all in uniform. But you see, they had light trousers or dark trousers, light or dark tunics, forage caps or cheese cutters, as we used to call them, and other variations on the dress. And the number of permutations, and some had no coats at all, no overcoats. Some would have overcoats, some would have raincoats. And the combination of all these things was such that no two American officers were dressed alike. And yet they were all American officers, nothing else but, rather like dogs. I mean, dogs can vary enormously in physical thing, can't they, from Pekingese to a bloodhound or something. And yet they're all dogs. And I always thought American officers were rather like that. Anyway, I'm getting off the track.
How did they... What was their kind of technical competence?
Oh, pretty good, pretty good. But they had—they were rather complimentary, because we had the British-built light warning, which we called the Type 6, and that had been made by Metropolitan Vickers at Manchester, who made a lot of the radars during the war. And they were complimentary about it, because apparently there was an American version, which they had been trying out in Florida, and they'd had a lot of faults on the American one, and they said that they thought that in some respects the British equipment was better. I remember them saying that, which, and they, you know, they wouldn't have said that unless they felt compelled to do so. But there is a technical competence that was quite good. Oh, we also had other Americans. Talking of Americans, yes, we had some other funny fellows who joined us during the war, who wore uniform. They were Americans. They came over from America wearing a funny uniform, but they were not actually military people. Could it have been Civilian Technical Corps, CTC or something like that? Some, I may have got it wrong, but they were chaps who came over, American radio engineers who joined, were let into the RAF, and they lived with the RAF, and they lived in the same living accommodation as the RAF people, but they didn't go on parades and do any of that sort of stuff. But they used to come down and take their place in the classes, and they went out into the radar chain as radar mechanics. But I think I'm right in saying that their technical competence was a bit on the low side. We were a bit disappointed with them. They were not as good on the whole. Individuals may have been, but on the whole they were not as good as our own recruits. But the other Americans I was talking about, they were certainly quite good. There's another point about the Americans I was going to mention. It's gone for the moment.
Mm-hmm. And these transmitters and receivers you were talking about, like the MB2, RF6, RF7 and so on, were they manufactured in government establishments privately?
The transmitters, the MB2s, and also the big... The MB2s were used on the West Coast CH stations. The East Coast CH stations had a much bigger transmitter, bigger physically and slightly more powerful. All the transmitters were made by Metropolitan Vickers at Manchester. So it was a civilian organisation making equipment under contract to the, I suppose it would be the Air Ministry or Ministry of Supply, I'm not sure, under classified and secret conditions. They did very well. And the receivers were made by Cossers, AC Cosser in London. They were the receiver manufacturers. But then when we got onto other radars, like the CHL radars, the receivers were made by... High at Cambridge, and a lot of other. I mean, most of the, if you look back now, you find that most of the radio industry in this country was engaged in radar one way or another, although it may not have realised it at the time. People like RGD, the Radio Gramophone Development Company, they were making trainers for CH, but they didn't know. Well, I suppose they knew it, but not some people in the company did, but probably not all. So the answer is, most of these equipments were made by civilian companies. I think the exception was some of the very early models, like the GH that I mentioned earlier, the navigational system. The early models of that were made at Malvern in the workshops at TRE. But eventually, of course, it went out to some civilian company for production. I'm not sure which it would have been. It might have been Echoes or McMichaels or something like that.
Did you have much contact with the representatives of these firms?
No, not much. We had a man who came down once or twice from Metropolitan Vickers to Yatesbury to do something on the transmitters, but no direct contact at all. No, I personally didn't. But I'm sure that others would have done, you know. It's just that I didn't personally.
So one gets the impression as an outsider that it was a period of very rapid technical development because of the pressures of war.
Yes, I think so too. And I think that I think it's interesting that we, as although I was, as I say, at Gatesbury most of the time, I did get out onto radar stations on detachments from time to time and took a hand in the maintenance there. I think that we were allowed to make ad hoc modifications to keep the stuff going, which I think, from what I gather, is rather in rather different from the German situation. I think the Germans are much more rigid. I think that when a unit failed in Germany, it was replaced with an identical unit, which they got from Telefunken or Siemens, or if they hadn't got one, they got one and put it in. I don't think the chaps who were operating and looking after the German radars had quite the same facility to make do and mend as that we used to have.
What kind of ad hoc changes?
Well, I mean, you'd put in a non-standard resistor or a non-standard capacitor or something like that, or you would perhaps short something out, or if one of the receiver stages on the RF7 failed, there were five intermediate frequency stages. If one stage failed, you'd swap over the anode caps so that you worked on four stages temporarily instead of five and turn up the gain to compensate and that sort of thing. And all sorts of ways you might substitute different cables than the cables which were put in originally. You might substitute different generator or something like that. I think you could imagine a situation where this would not have been permitted because it would not have been according to the book. But these things were sort of overcome by a bit of ingenuity and general resourcefulness on everybody's part. And I think, as I've said in that thing that I've given you, which I've been writing, that I think one of the strengths of the RAF was that they trained people very, very well indeed. I think, if anything, we almost overtrained the people, because we told them how the circuits worked and the reasons behind things and why the design had been this way and the other, so that if they were in a situation where they were up against it, they could make their own decision about how to do a modification, you know, on the spot. And I think that's a strength. Some of my people might regard it as a weakness, but I think it's a strength that the RAF had, which enabled them to keep going under very difficult conditions.
What about, there must have been similar training going on in the Army and Navy in parallel, was there?
Oh yes, there was. Certainly there was. The Army had a radar school. Was it Arborfield or somewhere? I think they had it. And the Navy had naval establishments, naval signal school and that sort of thing. Yes, there must have been similar training going on, but I can't answer for it in detail. I didn't witness it, so whether it was better training or worse training, I can't say.
So they were in parallel and completely separate from your own personal point of view?
Yes, they were. Yes, from my personal point of view, they were separate, yes. I think that they came together, in a sense, at Malvern, in that TRE at Malvern was, I think, doing work for all services, certainly for the Army and the Air Force. Although I've got the impression that Navy tended to be a little bit separate in all its doings. And I've seen one or two references to that recently. I've seen some wartime papers on radar naval development, which seems to indicate that the Navy were tending to go it alone to some extent. Although it's not entirely true, because the centimetric radars that we used when they came into service in the RAF, they were basically naval radars which had been adapted for ground use. It was called NT-277, which is naval type 277, and NT-271 and so forth. And then they got their own RAF numbers. But obviously somebody in the hierarchy, in the technical hierarchy, had got the sense to use what was available in one service for another service, which is very fortunate.
Did you ever come across any security breaches yourself?
No, I don't think I did. I don't think I did. I think the secret was remarkably well kept. It was drilled into us that we mustn't even say words like RF6 or MB2 outside the compound of the radio school or outside the compound of a radar station. We were not allowed to even mention the names or the words or any reference to it anywhere outside. And it was so impressed upon us that I think people stuck to it very well. I don't remember any security breaches. There probably were some, but I don't remember any.